Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
General Motors is making money, and oil hit $103 a barrel today. One of those things is not likely to last. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com. Protecting and improving your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. And by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, today the 24th of February. Good to have you with us. American capitalism is a rough and tumble place. One need look no further than General Motors today to see that that is true. GM posted its first annual profit since 2004 this morning. The $4.7 billion the company earned for all of last year was its biggest profit in more than a decade. An impressive turnaround by any measure, given where GM is coming from. And yet shares traded below the price at which they went public back on the market, that is, in November. Investors are casting a wary eye on a downward trend in GM's earnings. And the benefits of bankruptcy protection the company enjoyed are giving way to the hard realities of a competitive and oh-so-fickle marketplace. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
GM's quarterly profits have actually been shrinking lately, not growing, and the CEO of the auto industry research firm Edmunds, Jeremy Anwyl, wonders if the fates will be as kind as they have been up to now. He says GM is increasingly focused on luring in customers.
They've been ramping up their spending on marketing and incentives. Their incentives are pretty much leading the industry again, and that's been crimping profitability.
Reinvention is the only way we can fix this, and fix it we will.
GM is following through with the bold changes it promised in its advertising when it went bankrupt 2 years ago, but Anwyl says it's a slow process.
It takes, you know, 3 to 4 years minimum to bring out a new vehicle, and they just had out of necessity to conserve cash. I mean, they were in survival mode. Now, of course, that's a big problem because they need new and exciting vehicles. That's what moves in this marketplace.
The new focus on gas mileage has better positioned GM to deal with fickle customers if pump prices go up and stay there. At the University of Michigan, industry expert Bruce Belzowski credits tighter CAFE standards, corporate average fuel economy.
When the government took over at General Motors, they didn't have a choice about what their product plan was going to be. The government said, we're going for higher CAFE standards. And if you want to survive as a manufacturing company, you're going to meet those standards.
But other industry observers doubt whether GM could meet a surge in customer demand right now for Chevy's fuel-efficient Cruze and all-electric Volt. Bob Schultz watches the auto industry for Standard & Poor's.
Clearly, it is a work in progress, and you know there is a bit of a race there between the evolving car lineup and you know, where fuel prices go.
Schultz says there's no question GM is better placed to be competitive in dealing with surging gas prices than it was in 2008. But he says GM remains heavily dependent on more profitable light trucks. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Traders at the New York Mercantile Exchange backed off oil today. Crude actually closed down for the first time all week after topping $103, as I said, although it is still in the mid-90s, and things still aren't going well in Libya. There are reports that as much as half of Libya's especially desirable kind of crude, light, sweet, and more easily refinable, has been shut down. Libya and a lot of other countries in the Middle East are often described as being oil-rich. And somehow leaders always find ways to enrich themselves. But what about average citizens? We asked Marketplace's Jeff Tyler what it really means to be oil rich.
Libya has had steady income from oil for 60 years. Dartmouth College professor Dirk van der Walle has studied the results.
For the average Libyan, oil has not really been an enormous blessing. There hasn't been a kind of real trickle-down effect that you would expect.
You might expect oil money would benefit everybody, But in both Libya and Saudi Arabia, Vandewalle says oil wealth has mostly been used by the elite to consolidate power.
75% of Libyans work for the state. That does provide an enormous amount of patronage and power to the state.
What about Saudi Arabia? I asked Toby Jones with Rutgers University, is Saudi Arabia anything like Alaska, where every resident gets a check with a cut of the state's oil largesse?
No. Saudis don't have a direct deposit into their checking account. But everybody in the kingdom understands that what they're after is a little slice of that oil revenue that comes into the kingdom, and they're entirely dependent on the royal family to make sure that they get it.
Patronage takes different shapes. It could mean a government job or health care or subsidized water. Saudi Arabia has spent billions of dollars on infrastructure, building airports, highways, hospitals, and ports. But in terms of diversifying the economy, Tom Lippman with the Council on Foreign Relations has been visiting Saudi Arabia for 30 years.
That's how long I've been hearing conversations about diversifying the economy. They're really just beginning to do that.
King Abdullah has ambitious plans to build new business-friendly cities where economic development could thrive, but nothing has been completed. Lippman says oil wealth has undermined any national sense of industrial drive.
It's the same reason you don't want your child to inherit $5 million on his 15th birthday, let's say. I mean, you get rich overnight, you get lazy.
That might not sit well with Saudi job seekers facing unemployment rates as high as 25%. Meanwhile, this oil-rich nation imports about 6 million foreign workers to do the jobs Saudis can't or won't do. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, stocks didn't do much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. When people go overseas to work, they often send money back to their families at home. Those remittances, as they're called, are often an important source of income for families, but also for entire national economies. In some places, though, Egypt and Jordan being two good examples, it isn't farmhands or domestic workers sending cash home. It's skilled professionals, and that presents a problem in itself. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports now from Amman.
There's really only one reason Fahi Mustafa Mahmoud wants to work abroad. He needs money. And he's not making enough in Jordan.
Here, the life expenses are extremely high. What you take as a salary is just to cover the very basic needs. It's unfortunate. So we're trying to get better salaries.
He's sitting in an employment agency in Amman, waiting to interview for a job in Saudi Arabia. But Mahmoud is no manual laborer. He's a professor of physiology at a private university here. There's something like 250,000 Jordanians who work abroad. Most of them are in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. More than 80% of those are thought to be skilled or highly educated. And it's not just Jordanians. Egypt, Syria, Tunisia, and other countries throughout the region send their best and brightest to the Gulf to earn a decent salary. Bassem Tlaylan runs the employment agency. He's just gotten a bunch of new job listings, and he's asking his colleagues to search the agency's database for OBGYNs and ophthalmologists and ENTs who are board certified in Jordan, the U.S., or the U.K. He says doctors can earn as much as 250% more by taking a job abroad. And it's not just doctors. He can't keep up with the demand for accountants or engineers or teachers either. Jordan's government actively promotes these relationships. Jordan has a real problem with unemployment, especially among young, educated people. And the overseas jobs bring in lots of money via remittances, officially more than $3 billion a year, which is about 10% of Jordan's GDP. But they also add up to a pretty serious brain drain for Jordan. Sami Mahmoud, who's no relation to the physiologist, is a physics professor at Jordan University. He says he sees a lot of brain drain, especially among recent graduates, and he says that's bad for Jordan's future.
There is less professionals in the society than really needed for the economic development and for the production. it influences the production rate and the quality of knowledge, the quality of educational system.
Mahmoud, the physiologist, says he's been offered jobs abroad over the years, but he never wanted to take them.
But now, because of the increasing responsibility...
He and his wife have 7 children.
I mean, all of my children, I have paid for them all their fees in the universities. And now the education has become extremely expensive.
If he takes a job outside of Jordan, he'll probably leave his family behind because most of the contracts are annual and it's just too much to uproot them all. He says in his culture, you don't think about yourself. The parents suffer to make the future better for their children. In Amman, Jordan, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Here's one for all the renters out there. Experian, one of the big 3 consumer credit bureaus, has started adding rent payment history into its reports. That's in addition to things like credit cards and mortgage payments. And Marketplace's Sarah Gardner explains that's actually good news for the growing number of Americans paying their landlord instead of their bank.
1/3 of Americans are renters, and that number is growing thanks in part to the mortgage crisis. Gail Cunningham is with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. She says Experian's move could potentially help millions of Americans get back on track.
So many folks out there are trying to rebuild their credit and are having a very difficult time doing so. This will allow millions of consumers to begin rebuilding or establishing perhaps for the first time their own credit.
Those first-timers include people like students or recent immigrants who have trouble establishing a credit history because they don't have homes or credit cards. Of course, rental data could work against them as well, says Greg McBride of Bankrate.com.
People that won't benefit are, you know, the people that have trouble making those rent payments. Skipping out on the rent or punching holes in the wall is going to cost you more than your security deposit.
Experian will initially only report positive rental data, but by next year it plans to throw in negative histories too. But the big question is whether the rental data will affect the ability of consumers to get bank loans. Liz Pulliam-Weston is the author of The 10 Commandments of Money. She says most banks use FICO scores to make loan decisions, and FICO's creators haven't yet decided whether to incorporate the rental data into their formula.
So if FICO isn't playing ball, then the impact of this is going to be pretty limited.
Right now, over 90% of banks and credit unions use FICO scores when deciding whether to give out a loan. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Coming up, paired pricing for what you put in your gas tank and what you pour in your wine glass.
I would not be surprised if we take 50 commodities and find very similar results to what we found for crude oil and fine wine.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, it could have been worse than it was earlier in the trading session. The Dow Industrials wrapped up with a loss of just 37 points, nearly 1/3 of 1%, settled at 12,068. The NASDAQ carved off 14 points, about 0.5%. 2737. The S&P 500 nudged lower by a single point, 0.1%, came to rest at 1306. The market spelled relief with 3 letters today, O, I, and L. The price of crude retreated from a 2.5-year high, as I mentioned. That on assurances from Saudi Arabia and the U.S. government that stockpiles are enough to handle demand. That sent ConocoPhillips prices tumbling off nearly 1.75%. ExxonMobil leaked off 1.25%. Chevron slipped about 0.25%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Ally Bank, offering its Raise Your Rate CD as well as an online savings account and money market account. Learn more at allybank.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. The Commerce Department issues the second estimate gross domestic product report for the fourth quarter. The National Association of Realtors releases its quarterly commercial forecast. And the United States Conference of Mayors concludes its winter leadership meeting in Washington. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Today, the Air Force finalized one of the biggest defense contracts ever. Boeing is going to be paid $35 billion to build nearly 200 air-to-air refueling tankers. It beat out EADS, the European Aerospace Defense Consortium. And I said finalize the contract more in hopefulness than in expectation. This is the third time the Pentagon has tried to pick a winner in the tanker wars. And the lobbying has been fierce. Earlier today, at what you have to believe was later than the last minute, the governors of Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana all wrote to President Obama, pointing out that an EADS win would have meant a boost for Gulf Coast jobs. They seemed to have believed that EADS would have built the tankers in Mobile, Alabama. Boeing is going to hire in Kansas and Washington State instead. Our Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has been covering this story for years now, and he's not so sure that we're done.
This is a saga of corruption, competition, and patriotism in three acts, at least so far. Nearly a decade ago, the Air Force gave Boeing a no-bid contract to replace a fleet of flying gas stations. It was a sweet deal for Boeing, but not for taxpayers, and that got Congress's attention. And so did blatant corruption. The Air Force official who negotiated the contract was also arranging for a cushy job with Boeing. The Air Force yanked the contract, and the former official went to jail. But Boeing really wanted that contract.
It's totally sweet. This plane will go on forever.
Defense analyst Gordon Adams.
It's not just the $35 billion. It's all the follow-on work. It's the spare parts. It's the supplies. It's the repairs. It's replacing the wing skins. It's the next generation.
One other company really wanted that contract, too. When the Air Force put the tanker up for bid, Europe's EADS got in the game. It draped itself in American flags, partnering with Northrop Grumman and picking a factory in Alabama. It worked. In 2008, EADS landed the contract. That was a shock for lawmakers like Norman Dix, the congressman from Boeing's then-home state of Washington.
It is wrong to outsource a contract of this magnitude to the Europeans. They would never do it for us.
When government investigators found the Air Force had skewed their scores in favor of EADS, the Buy America crowd in Congress made the Air Force reconsider. Start Act 3. EADS partner Northrop dropped out in disgust, and so did Boeing. But billions are billions, and Boeing and EADS were soon back. Then Gordon Adams says the Air Force stumbled again.
Air Forces occasionally look like the Keystone Cops here.
The Air Force handed each competitor a CD with information on the other's bid. One thing is for sure, the Air Force is open to court challenges. So while the billions won't flow right away, a lot of lawyers will have no trouble financing vacation homes. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
With smartphone prices falling, people who really want one already have one, which clears the way for the next great struggle for the hearts and minds of technology consumers, tablets. Apple has sold 15 million iPads just in the last year. Analysts figure consumers worldwide are going to buy anywhere from 50 to 200 million tablets of all makes and models in the next couple of years. And today, the competition really got going. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Today, Motorola started selling its Zoom tablet. It's faster than the iPad, has two cameras and stereo speakers. But Michael Gartenberg, a consumer analyst at Gartner, says there's one big catch. The Zoom is $800.
If you're going to spend that kind of money, the odds are you probably at least want to see what Apple is going to be offering next.
You won't have to wait long. Apple's expected to unveil the next generation iPad next week. Right now, a similar iPad costs $729, and the cheapest is just $499. Dan Olds at the Gabriel Consulting Group says for many consumers, a tablet is almost an impulse buy.
For a lot of people, it's going to be that second or third device.
that is one reason why tablets are successful with them is because they are so inexpensive.
Old says for companies who want to create an iPad killer, the strategy is pretty straightforward.
I would come in with something that is more powerful, more fully featured, with as many apps as I could possibly get, and I'd come in at a lower price.
Easy for Olds to say. The thing is, undercutting Apple on price won't be easy. Apple's spent billions locking up key parts of its tablet supply chain, buying up touchscreens and other components. That's going to make it tough for competitors like Motorola to build a better machine for less. There is one market player, though, that's nearly certain to emerge victorious from the tablet wars: the consumer. In the next year, we can all expect features on tablets to flourish while prices fall. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
More tablets next year is not soon enough for the producers of this year's Oscars. They're all about iPads and smartphones and live streaming for the broadcast Sunday night. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has more now on Oscar 2.0.
Oscar dresses, Oscar favorites, Oscar parties. There's an app for that. Mark Stagi is the co-founder of App Easy, creator of the Oscar Awards Hero iPhone app.
People can create an Oscar pool with their friends and kind of see who can get the best number of picks right.
So far, 10,000 people have bought the app. That kind of social media is creating more interest in events like the Oscar for viewers and advertisers, says Brad Adgate with Horizon Media.
The amazing thing is it's really helping, you know, traditional media like television. It's really given it a spike.
In 2008, Oscar viewership hit an all-time low. But with the help of Twitter, Facebook, and apps, viewership has climbed 30% since then. The Grammys just saw its highest ratings in a decade, and Super Bowl viewership set an all-time record. Author and New Yorker staff writer Susan Orlean spent the morning tweeting about her new Oscar app.
It's like a 24-hour-a-day run-up to the Oscars. It promises all those extra camera angles on the red carpet that you might miss.
Orlean says social media makes televised events more exciting to watch.
Something like the State of the Union or the Oscars, it's an event. And if you aren't actually sitting with a large group of people, but you can kind of interact online with other people watching, that's the whole point. It's a spectator sport.
The market is growing. At the end of this year, it's estimated more than half of all Americans will have a smartphone, and the tablet wars are just beginning. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
We've got Oscar by the numbers on our website, Academy Award Facts and Figures. Marketplace.org is the link. Crude prices, as I mentioned earlier, did give back just a little bit today, but the trend line is sure up. And when oil is higher, you know what else tends to follow? Well, yeah, pump prices, but that's not the answer I'm looking for. Try high-end red wine. That's the takeaway from a study by the International Monetary Fund. It's lighthearted in that IMF kind of way, but it does make a serious point about commodity and energy markets. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
What is the link between crude oil and wine? Both have light sweet varieties. Drinking and driving, there's a crack to be made there. But Serhan Cevik at the IMF has a better explanation. He looked at oil prices the last two decades and compared them to an index of fine wines, mostly French. And voila.
It turned out that the results were quite robust.
In economics, that's called an understatement. The price correlation topped 90%. Those numbers, and a very cool topic, have turned Cevik and his co-author into mini-celebs.
I never heard somebody call an IMF paper cool, but from that point of view, it's quite encouraging.
Now, here's the why. He found the prices of both liquid assets boom and bust because of changes in demand. No, not demand from rich countries, ours stays pretty steady, but from emerging markets. It's the new wealthy in new countries that move markets.
As they become richer, they demand greater energy, greater amount of commodities, and wine as well.
Which reminds me of a wine and dine weekend I attended 2 years ago in China. The tycoon hosting it meant it expressly for rich people. Clearly a bit fuzzy on compensation and public radio. We sampled caviar, premium cognac.
Creation.
Like Creation from Jean Martel, $300 a bottle. And we drank Bordeaux, which is fitting because China just leapfrogged the U.S. as the biggest overseas market for Bordeaux. This is some of the priciest wine. Chinese billionaire property developer Wang Shi explains the appeal.
There's a joke that goes, we don't look for the best, we look for the most expensive.
That suggests the streets of Shanghai and Mumbai and Dubai are filled with shoppers who think expensive equals good. It makes sense to Chip Chaikin at the private equity firm Blue Point Capital. He's a China long-timer.
People used to keep their tags on their suits sticking on the outside so they could indicate to people that it was a high-end brand and that they paid a lot for it.
Now, before you smirk at those Chinese people, consider not long ago, it was us.
I'm sure that the high-end French vineyards looked down their nose when they had to sell the wine to newly wealthy Texans a couple generations ago, and it's sort of now the entrepreneurial Chinese turn, but money and sophistication doesn't always go together, and sometimes that second one lags a little bit.
Global markets don't care. So long as emerging markets buy, prices stand to rise, whatever the commodity, says Chevik at the IMF. Wheat, rice, coal, Chateau Latour.
I would not be surprised if we take 50 commodities and find very similar results to what we found for crude oil and fine wine.
Now, if you invest in wine, he suggests you cork your enthusiasm. The paper argues that wine tracks other investments, so it's a lousy portfolio diversifier. Harvard economist Robert Stavins agrees wine's a risky venture, and he should know. He edits the Journal of Wine Economics.
Only the premium, the top five wines from Bordeaux, Lafitte, Rothschild, Latour, Margaux, Aubryon, and Mouton, have consistently beat the stock market.
You might think this brainy economist is one of the few qualified to dabble in a bit of Bordeaux speculation. But does he? He's a mutual fund guy.
My portfolio investments is much like yours and everyone else's. I do have a substantial stock of wine in my cellar, but that's because I want to age that wine.
In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, focused on finding opportunities one stock at a time, on the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, an observation that our story yesterday about high-end retail doing pretty well in a still fragile economy does have some limits. We learned today that the 2011 Washington, D.C. boat show schedule for this weekend has been postponed. That's the official word. It's been postponed until 2012. A notice on the boat show's website says that neither marine dealers' interests nor the boating public's enjoyment will be furthered by producing a show in the current economic climate. They're keeping their fingers crossed for next year, it seems. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 37 points, nearly a third of 1%. The NASDAQ gave back 14 points, about a half percent. Yes, S&P 500 whittled off a point, a tenth of 1%. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back here, what movie buffs look for in a really good trailer.
There are television shows about movie trailers. They're on the internet. They can see them and they analyze them almost as entertainment content themselves.
I'm Kai Rizdal. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.